Imagining America is made possible with a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and is distributed by WGBH Radio, Boston.
Randall Hollick is unable to come to the phone right now. He's away in Europe recording a program called Winnetou and Old Shatterhand about cowboys and Indians and the myth of the American frontier in Europe. If you need to get hold of him, he's spending the weekend in Carcassonne in the south of France. Please leave your name and number after the beep.
Let's go!
Éric Pécou, je suis de la Haute-Savoie et tu fais ça depuis, ça fait le troisième rodéo que je fais, c'est tout moi dans ma vie quoi.
During the week, Éric Pécou is a butcher from Annecy in the French Alps. On the weekend, he's a bareback competitor in the Montana Ranch Rodeo. There are six bareback riders here, they're all friends. By American standards, the wild horses are really just ponies. But this time round, Pecco's drawn the one crazy of the whole lot. It's frothing and sweating and trying to climb out of the 8-foot-high steel pen. Pecco lowers himself onto the horse's back, swings his legs as far forward as they'll go, reins in his left hand, right hand's holding onto the pen for dear life. He has to stay on for 8 seconds. I ask Eric if this makes him an American cowboy. Well, if there are cowboys in America, he says, that's just pure coincidence.
Si les cowboys, si les Américains font pareil, coïncidence.
Eric's been thrown. Laurent, a pickup man, circles on his horse Natchez, lasso in hand, while Andy, the German circus clown, dressed in sneakers and red basketball shorts, draws the bronco away from Eric.
Thank you, Andy. Good morning. Wow. You're sexy today. 15
cowboys, carrying the stars and stripes and French tricolour, enter the arena led by Michel Perret. Michel, or Mick as he prefers to be called, loves riding Western style. He's visited Montana and Wyoming many times. If he could be born again, he'd like to be born a cowboy full time. Right now, he has to settle for interior decorating in Paris. The rest of his time and money's gone into Montana Ranch, an old rambling farm southwest of Paris, where anyone can come and learn to ride. This is only the second rodeo Mick's put on, and he's not having much luck. The first one 2 weeks ago, it started snowing, and nobody came. This one almost got cancelled last night. It rained 8 inches in 24 hours, and the River Aude on the far side of the Hippodrome Municipal burst its banks. The show jumping had to be cancelled, the big top collapsed. The caterer tried to make a getaway with the food. He revved his truck right up to the rear axle in the mud, and he's not going anywhere today. The organisers wanted to call the rodeo off because they can claim against their insurance. But Michel can't, and he's already spent a small fortune bringing 15 horses and riders down here with all the rodeo equipment. So although the ground's dangerously soft, and everyone in Carcassonne's gone to the rugby match a mile up the road, because rugby's religion round here. Mick says, on with the show. On the surface, this could be any small town rodeo in Colorado or Wyoming. A French imitation of that most American of events, the very essence of the myth of the Old West. But the content, the reality behind the spurs and the chaps is very different. For these French cowboys and for millions of other Europeans, the Wild West is alive and well in Europe, but it's a Wild West that has very little to do with a reality called America. The Wild West for many Europeans has been, always will be, a mythical place where Europeans can stage their own adventures, fight their own quarrels, dream their own dreams. If the Wild West had never existed, then Europe would have had to invent it.
The so-called Western myth is a European myth. When every frontier in Europe was conquered, every wilderness was cultivated, the people still have a need for a dream of something fresh, new, original.
Kjell Halbing's a modern-day dime novelist living in Norway. Kjell's written over 83 Western adventures, some of them in collaboration with his friend Stig Thornsen, who lives in Denmark. Stig's also spent most of his life teaching and writing about the Far West. He sees America as very much a part of Scandinavian culture.
The Viking is a cowboy, or rather, the cowboy is just a Viking. You can take any of the ideologies out of any Western, and you're looking at the Icelandic sagas written down 700-800 years ago.
Americans have been raised on the notion that the frontier is something quintessentially American. It defines American character and its self-images. But the frontier is also a European myth. After all, what else is America but Europe's own search for the last frontier? And the cowboy, just another white colonial in search of adventure at the expense of nature and the heathen savage.
For Americans, the myth of the West is a myth of creation. We are what we did in the West. For Europeans, the myth of the West is a myth of civilization confronting innocence, confronting wilderness, and that's very different.
Paul Fees is director of the Buffalo Bill Museum in Cody, Wyoming.
To a European, the West is a nice setting for the confrontation of good and evil. It's a place where the same rules of civilization that obtain in Europe don't obtain. So consequently, the European writers and mythmakers can write their own rules. It was also a way of disguising discussions of their own social concerns.
Remember Lilliput? Jonathan Swift's imaginary land, peopled with imaginary little people? Well, Swift invented them to better comment on his native England. And that's basically the role the West plays in Europe's imagination. Of course, America and Americans are real enough. But you mightn't think so, judging by how Europeans have imagined the Native American, or as every European still calls him, the Red Indian. From the beginning, Europeans can never make up their minds about the Red Indian. Is he human or animal? Can you talk with him or should you hunt him? That's important because if you consider him a fellow human being, that means he's capable of conversion to Christianity. And if you're the king or queen of 16th century Spain, then it means lots of power and prestige. You've discovered a whole new world for the Catholic Church. Of course, if he's a savage beast, you can hunt him and torture him, kill him, and take his land with a clear conscience. Then again, you might also say that everything about the Indian suggests he's rarely an innocent, living in a society unblemished by all the vices and decadence that Europeans call civilization. Some see him as a throwback to the supposed golden age when men were free and didn't need laws and constraints on their behavior. In fact, in many paintings and sculptures right from the early 16th through the 19th centuries, Indians look exactly like Greeks or Romans. They just happen to have copper-colored skin and shaved heads. Now, what all this means is summed up in Rousseau's famous phrase, the noble savage. The Indian is how we could be if we could only throw off the yoke of despotism and tyranny. James Fenimore Cooper popularized him, but the first frontier bestseller, the granddaddy of them all, was Atala, written in 1800 by the French Catholic writer Chateaubriand. Nobody reads Atala now, which is a pity, but it inspired operas and goodness knows how many paintings and statues and prints that must have hung above many a fireplace. The whole thing is improbably melodramatic. But it's a wonderful example of what happens when the noble savage meets European romanticism. And of course, it's got almost nothing to do with America.
I'm Choctaw of the Natchez tribe. I was captured by the Muscogee in the Floridas and escaped, thanks to the beautiful Atala. She fled with me here, to the forests of the Ohio. Last night, Atala told me her secret. She's only half Indian. Her father was a Spaniard. I think she thought I would be shocked.
An old French hermit, Father Aubry, gives them shelter, offers to instruct Choctaw in the Christian gospel so he can be married to Atala. Choctaw is bubbling over with anticipation and happiness. But Atala suddenly says she doesn't feel well. The two men want to go and visit Father Aubry's flock, a tribe of Indians he's converted to Christianity. Atala begs off, stays behind in the hermit's grotto. Choctaw and Father Aubry return as dusk falls. Atala is sick, very sick.
The hermit had lit a pine torch and was holding it in his trembling hand over Atala's couch. The beautiful young woman was half raised on her elbow, pale and disheveled. Beads of pain-laden sweat glistened on her brow.
Father, I am on the verge of death. Oh, Choctaw, do not despair, but listen to the fatal secret which I have hidden from you. When I was born, my life was given up for lost, and to save me from death, my mother vowed to the Queen of Angels that if I were spared, I would live my life a virgin. At first, I was not aware of the danger of my oath. I saw all about me only men unworthy of receiving my hand. I took pride in having no husband other than the god of my mother. Then I laid eyes on you, handsome young captive, and I felt the full weight of my vows. What plans I treasured, what dreams came from my saddened heart. Sometimes, as I fixed my eyes upon you, my desires would go to the wildest and most forbidden extremes. I wanted to be the only living creature on earth with you.
My dear child, your impulsive imagination has given you needless alarm about your vows. If, as I hope, it is his will that you recover from this illness, I shall write to the Bishop of Quebec. He has the power to absolve you of your vows, which are not permanently binding. And you will end your days beside me, with Choctaw as your husband.
There was a solution. I could have been absolved of my vows.
Yes, my daughter. And there is still time.
Be calm, and we shall yet taste of that happiness.
Never, never. You do not know all. It was yesterday, during the storm. I was about to break my vow. I foresaw my weakness. And when I left the cabins, I took along with me...
What?
Poison?
It is in my breast. Chattas, dear friend, you have made me infinitely happy. Help me untie this crucifix around my throat, Chattas. Keep it as a memory of our sorrows. Chattas, I have one last request to make of you. Dear friend, our union on earth could only have been short, but there is, after this life, a longer life. How terrible it would be to be separated from you forever. Today, I am only going on before you, and I shall wait for you in the celestial realm. If you have loved me, learn the lessons of the Christian faith, and it will prepare our reunion.
It is time. Time to summon God hither. Depart, Christian soul. Go forth and rejoin thy Creator.
Father, will this remedy restore Atala to life?
Yes, my son. To life eternal.
Atala had just breathed her last.
Atala was merely the first in a long line of so-called 19th century European Westerns. Most of them a pure boy's own. A young white European sowing his oats, seeking adventure in an exotic clime, comes to America, heads out to the frontier, and absent-mindedly ends up rescuing a damsel in distress. It sounds awfully familiar. The locale's usually New Mexico or Arizona, about as far removed from Paris, Brighton, or Berlin as can safely be imagined. In most of these adventures, and in the real life of European immigrants, Red Indians are savages, intrinsically evil, obstacles to the great 19th century god called progress. Even as distinguished a visitor as Charles Dickens views the Red Indian as little better than vermin.
I call him a savage, and I call a savage something highly desirable to be civilized off the face of the earth.
But in 19th century Germany, something totally different happens. The tragic fate of the Indian only makes him more attractive to a culture naturally inclined to romanticism.
It's a gorgeous morning here in the woods near the little town of Hohenstein-Ernstein in the former East German state of Saxony. After the terrible spring we've had here in Europe, perhaps the first real day of summer. Sunbeams pouring through the branches, birds singing, a tiny stream of what appears to be unpolluted water. And the voices of young children out on what you might think was a nature ramble, but is in fact a visit to an abandoned tin mine, where more than 120 years ago, a man named Karl May hid for several days from the town police. With me is Eckhard Froder, the tall, bubbly director of the Karl May House in Ernstein. Froder's busy telling the life story of Karl May to the children.
Winnetou kennt ihr. Wir gehören zu Winnetou immer dazu. Ein Chatterhand, richtig. Kennt ihr noch jemanden?
Karl May was born here in 1842 into a very poor family of weavers. The first 30 or so years of his life, he seems to have been your basic juvenile delinquent. Petty theft, obtaining money under false pretenses, impersonation, you name it, he seems to have done it. But then something miraculous happens. The petty criminal starts to write. He starts to weave fantastic tales about Germany, about the Middle East, about the Far West, 75 volumes in all, until his death in 1912.
If anybody is interested to study the German soul, he must also touch Karl May's ideas. This is like a fairy tale in the German minds. And Karl May is open for them the world.
Joachim Schmidt is one of two surviving brothers who own and run the Karl May Verlag or publishing company. Probably the only example of a publisher able to survive and prosper off the works of just one author.
In German, they will have counted around 80 million copies from the Karl May books we can count. It will be the most readed author in the German language.
After the Bible or before the Bible?
I think besides the Bible. And the Bible is only one volume. Huh?
In fact, with translations and editions put out by other publishers, total sales probably top 100 million. Karl May has this effect on yesterday's children. They can always remember reading their first Karl May book. Klaus Franz is a school teacher near Stuttgart in Germany. When he was 11 years old, he helped the village priest organize the church library. At lunchtime, when they'd finished work for the day, the priest gave Klaus one of Karl May's books to read.
1 o'clock in the afternoon, I sit down on the stairs in front of the house, and I come back to reality at 6 o'clock in the evening, and I have read the whole book, and this happened 5 times the week.
By the end of that week, Klaus Franz had read 5 Karl May novels about the Wild West, and each one was almost 300 pages long. Perhaps the most remarkable thing about May's Wild West books is that he wrote them without ever going to America. He had a huge library of travel books and novels. From the former, he takes his landscapes, his descriptions of Indian customs, and more often they're right than wrong. The latter gives him his plots. He's read Cooper, his compatriots Gerstecker and Seelsfeld, the Frenchman Gabriel Ferré, or the Irishman Mayne Reid. He then reformulates them through his own prism and concerns until they in turn become perhaps the single most important source of images of America for at least 3 generations of German speakers in Central Europe. They're no longer just tales of the Wild West, they've become German stories. It just so happens they're set in an exotic landscape that few, if any, have yet seen.
My real name is Karl. But I'm known in the Great Plains as Old Shatterhand, because I can knock a man out with one blow of my fist. I joined a team in St. Louis in the 1860s to survey Texas and New Mexico for the new railroad. That's when I first met Winnetou. He and his father, Inchuchuna, rode into our camp and asked us what right we had to build a railroad when we didn't own the land.
May liked to claim that these were really his adventures, which was impossible, because he'd been serving time in Dresden when he claimed to have been in America. Some have also criticized Old Shatterhand as a forerunner of Hitler's Superman. It seems much more likely he's merely wish fulfillment for the diminutive and sickly May. And the fact that Hitler said May was his favorite author doesn't mean much either. Einstein, Thomas Mann, Schweitzer, every young boy in the German-speaking world, and many in Poland, Czechoslovakia, or Holland, would have said exactly the same thing. Like Chateaubriand before him, however, May's most enduring creation is not a white man, but a red Indian. Here May's both a romantic and a realist. This is how he begins his greatest book, Winnetou.
The Indian race is dying. The white man came with sweet words on his lips, but had a sharp knife in his belt and a loaded rifle in his hand. The dying Indian could not be integrated into the white world. Was that reason enough to kill him? Could he not have been saved? I came to know the Indians over the course of a number of years, and one of them still lives brightly and magnificently in my heart. He, the best, the most loyal, and most devoted of all my friends, was a true representative of his race. I loved him as I have loved no other. I would gladly have given my life to protect his, as he risked it countless times to preserve mine. This was not to be. He died to save his comrades, but it is only his body that died. For he will survive in these pages, as he lives in my soul. Winnetou, the great chief of the Apaches.
Winnetou is not the silent sidekick to a white hero. He's not Tonto to old Shadhand's Lone Ranger. If anything, he's Carmi's version of Cooper's Indian hero in The Last of the Mohicans. Winnetou and old Shadhand always share equal billing. They're both heroic, both possessed of virtue. The great message of the books, the reason they appeal even now, is one of brotherhood between all men, whatever their beliefs or the colour of their skin. The tone is set early on. Old Shadhand and Winnetou start out as reluctant enemies and end up saving each other's lives. And then, in a ritual as German as they come, Winnetou's father, the great chief Inchichuna, unites Winnetou and Old Shatterhand as blood brothers. Winnetou turns to address the assembled Apaches.
Old Shatterhand will be blood of our blood and flesh of our flesh. Do the warriors of the Apache give their consent?
How?
Now, let Old Shatterhand and Winnetou step up to the coffin and let their blood drip into the water of brotherhood.
So this was to be a blood brotherhood. A real, true blood brotherhood of which I'd so often read. Inchichuna bared his son's lower arm to make a small incision. He then took mine and performed the same act. Some blood fell into the two bowls. Winnetou was given mine, and I his. Inchichuna solemnly intoned in English.
The soul lives in the blood. The soul of these two young warriors shall pass into each other so that they form one. Forthwith, what Old Shatterhand thinks shall also be Winnetou's thought. What Winnetou wants shall also be Old Shatterhand's will. Drink.
I emptied my bowl, and Winnetou his. The chief gave me his hand.
Like Winnetou, you are now the son of my body and a warrior of our people. The glory of your deeds will spread quickly, and no other warrior will surpass you. You join us as chief of the Apaches, and all the tribes of our people will honor you as such.
Winnetou is an extremely European Apache. He speaks fluent English. He carries round with him a copy of Longfellow's Hiawatha. Only one thing is lacking. He's not formally a Christian, but that too is resolved as he dies, murdered by a treacherous Yankee to the strains of the Ave Maria. Winnetou finally embraces Old Shatterhand's God. Perhaps the most surprising thing about Karl May is that he seems to have lost little of his popularity. It's hard to imagine his contemporaries, Jules Verne or Robert Louis Stevenson, exercising the same hold over children and adults in the late 20th century.
Karl May is a national institution.
Klaus Roxin's a law professor at Munich University. He's also president of the Karl May Society, 1,000 professors, literary critics, booksellers, even politicians, all linked by a scholarly determination to better understand May and his works. Off the top of my head, I can't think of many popular writers anywhere who have a society of over 1,000 scholars meeting and putting out a thick annual hardbound volume of literary analysis. Certainly not one who, by common agreement, was a popular writer, not a Goethe or a Schiller.
What Karl May has created is a popular myth. They are so deeply implanted into German soul that his figures have own life.
The filmmaker Hans-Jürgen Sieberberg is famous for a trilogy of films he made on Ludwig II of Bavaria, Adolf Hitler, and Karl May. Sieberberg maintains that all three are central to any real understanding of modern Germany.
It has something to do with myth, with myths of heart and soul, of a country, where things come together.
Sieberberg makes one further connection that I think's vital if one really wants to understand the why of Karl May's hold on the German cultural imagination. He says Karl May's the poor man's Richard Wagner, retelling the great myths of the Nibelungen, but in a language and format that every man can understand.
There's a connection between Wagner and Karl May. Both deal with myth. Wagner, of course, on a very high level, and Karl May for the other ones.
Wagner, of course, is an audiovisual myth maker, so it's not surprising he's maintained his popularity. Kids don't read so much today, and although Winnetou books are still bestsellers, you might think the myth would have begun to fade. But the Winnetou myth has also made the transition from the printed page to the screen, and even to popular theatre, and in doing so created a new myth.
Here in the little town of Bad Segeberg, north of Hamburg, Winnetou and Old Shatterhand live on in an 8-week series of summer performances that attract more than 300,000 spectators from all over Germany. It's almost a place of pilgrimage.
Liegt das rote Volk ausgestreckt, niedergestreckt, niedergeworfen von einem unerbittlichen Schicksal, das kein Erbarmen kennt.
The plays usually cling faithfully to the books, but Old Shatterhand and Winnetou no longer share equal billing.
Winnetou is no longer a figure created by Karl May, a German who has never heard his name and knows nothing about Karl May. In any case, he knows Winnetou. So Winnetou has become independent from his author. And that's what a myth is.
For it's now Winnetou, the chief of the Apaches, who has all the virtues. Old Shatterhand is merely his white sidekick. When French actor Pierre Brice, who's played Winnetou for more than 30 years, enters on his horse, the middle-aged crowd goes wild and weak at the same time. Partly from nostalgia, because as children they grew up with Brice as Winnetou, and partly at seeing a myth made flesh.
Und in unserem Herzen, Winnetou, der Häuptling aller Apachen.
Pierre Brice now is a living Winnetou. People in Germany recognize him as the real Winnetou, and so he is very famous, and I think still when he is 80 years old, he has to play Winnetou.
I expected most of the adult spectators to tell me that what they'd just seen was pure fantasy. Surprise, surprise.
Das ist noch die Frage, aber irgendwo stellt es doch das dar, was irgendwann wirklich passiert ist.
I think it's realistic. Somehow it really happened. It doesn't have to be now, but I don't know, 100 years ago or something, then it was real.
Others understand it as a parable that's entirely relevant to today's journey.
Dass die halt ein bisschen berücksichtigt werden und mal ein bisschen mit Liebe.
It's not an adventure story, it's a story from real life.
Auch unsere Geschichte so ein bisschen, ne?
It's like the story, it's like our story, the story of our lives that we have to deal with today.
He will be read in 50 years still, because it touches the German soul. So I think he will never be forgotten.
Yes, I will compare myself to Karl May, yes.
Kjell Halbing is a contemporary dime novelist. At last count, he'd written over 160 novels, of which over 80 are westerns, all in Norwegian, under his pen name Louis Masterson. After 9 years of silence, he's just published the first in a new series of books about his fictional hero, Morgan Cain.
The whole first printing of 100,000 books was sold in one day. And that's the new Norwegian record.
Will that make you about the most widely read, widely published, widely bought Norwegian author this year?
Yes, I think so. I think so. Because the first printing of 100 to 110, that is enormous. We are only 4 million people.
How many books have you sold since you started writing 25 years ago?
I think it's between 17 and 20 million books in all.
Halbing retired from working in an Oslo bank at the ripe age of 32. By then, he'd already written 25 books at the rate of one a month. Halbing's choice of the Western genre was plain opportunistic, and like Karl May, his initial knowledge of America was almost entirely from books.
I knew nothing about the world. I hadn't even been outside Norway. So the easiest thing to bluff was a Western. So I did.
And you counted on the fact that none of your readers would have been there either.
Well, I imagined that I could describe what I've seen 100 times as a kid. The same grey story, John Wayne, the early John Wayne, Alan Ladd. I've seen it. I remember it. I just started to fake it.
Since those early days, Kjell Halbing has been many times to the United States. He says he only ever found one real mistake. He had his hero Morgan Cain swim a river in Arizona. When he got there, he found it flowed underground. When I first read a Morgan Cain novel, I found the hero rather introverted and complex. He shot and beat up people all right, but he did seem a bit of a thinking man's cowboy. Kjell says that's because he's really not American at all.
He was more or less afraid to show any feelings. He didn't like big crowds, and he didn't like people standing too close to him. This guy could come from the east part of Oslo. So he's not typically a Western man. He could be any Norwegian boy.
Could be, and as Shell's friend Stig Thornton, himself a writer on America, says, if Morgan Cain's really a good Norwegian boy, where does that leave the Norwegian Western novel?
we're not just recreating the American myth or the American dream. Morgan Cain is not just a recreation of the big John Wayne dream or whatever happened over there. It is a transplantation of what has been going on here since the Vikings went to Iceland.
Look at the old sagas from the Viking or before the Vikings. Really, it's nothing new.
In other words, Stieg and Schell are still at the same old game, using an exotic setting to retell European mythology. Karl May and Chateaubriand exalted the noble savage, but Schell Halbing and the majority of dime novelists have chosen the cowboy as their hero, and they got many of their images from a very different source.
At the turn of the century, Buffalo Bill was probably the best-known American in Europe. He was probably the best-known American in the world.
He actually brought the West across the Atlantic. People didn't actually have to go from the UK to the States. It came to them. And they were overjoyed. They were overjoyed with the opportunity.
One of the things that assured the success was the fact that Buffalo Bill and those like him who followed him were immediately identifiable. They were absolutely recognizable to their British and French audiences. Buffalo Bill was a cavalier. He was one of Sir Walter Scott's characters. They really self-consciously assumed the trappings of chivalry. It included dressing up like the Three Musketeers.
Buffalo Bill's show first came to Europe in 1887. Over the next quarter of a century, it made more than a dozen visits, staying from 6 months up to a year at a time. For those who saw it, however young, it remained perhaps the single most important event in their lives. I've never forgotten when I was 4, seeing this tall cowboy in buckskins on a grey horse towering over me on the beach, urging my mother to take me to the Wild West show on the pier on Friday evening. I never did get to go. Years later, I discovered that it wasn't Buffalo Bill I'd seen, but one Colonel Edward Gray, who made a minor but profitable career for 50 years impersonating Buffalo Bill in seaside resorts in Britain and France. That's how famous Buffalo Bill was in Europe. Now, Charles Hand, a businessman from Liverpool, actually met the great man when he was a small boy and the Wild West show came to Liverpool. This is an extract from his autobiography, read by John Whelan.
I was a romantic boy who had ever shown an unusual excitement over the works of Fenimore Cooper and Captain Mayne Reid, and hadn't even despised, indeed, I'd secretly devoured, all the forbidden Western tales known to boys of my day as penny bloods. And all this was too much for me. Episodes of my young, bookish life were passing in procession before my eyes. I'd lived with my cowboy heroes and their enemies, who were my enemies, for several years, and now they'd come to live with me. 2 weeks of enchantment to look forward to, and the reenactment of the dramas of dreams. Something happened to me that day.
The kid wants to go to the show, but he doesn't have any money. He hangs outside the entrance to the showgrounds, dreaming of what it must be like. Then something wonderful happens. A cowboy comes out, sees him mooning around, scuffling up the dirt, and he asks if he wants to come in and see what's happening. They walk through past wigwams and horses, round the whole campground, until they're back facing the entrance and the end of the dream.
The flap was open, and as we came into its line of sight, a friendly, nasal voice addressed my companion.
That you, Jack?
Oh, howdy, Bill,
replied my friend. He stopped. I stopped too. Then my heart stopped, for an unmistakable figure stepped to the opening. It was Buffalo Bill! I lost complete control of my senses when Mustang Jack told me,
shake hands with Colonel Cody, son.
I did mechanically as I was bid and stared fascinated at the godlike figure in semi-military, semi-frontier raiment, with his imperial tufted beard and locks of hair turning grey hanging to his shoulders. Gone in an instant were my frustrations, my sense of inferiority. As I ran, for walking was too pedestrian for my mood, along the road to my home, I was bursting to unload my excitement. I felt a wonderful change had taken place in my state. I was somebody.
Without Buffalo Bill, I don't think the dime novel would have ever been as popular as it proved. And I wonder whether kids all over Europe would ever have really played cowboys and Indians.
He's making a break for it. Cover him!
When I was a kid, being Indian, oh my God, because an Indian in Norway, he's a hunter, the silent one. We put out sentries. The main point of this, we were 8, 10 years old, to sneak up and just touch him.
We did it with broomsticks. And my brother was always Davy Crockett because he had a Davy Crockett hat. I think I was a cowboy.
Between where I lived and the cinema, there were hedgerows. And when the cinema would let out, all the people who lived up my way, there would be literally dozens of kids running home, jumping over the hedgerows, smacking their backside as they went, because we'd all be reenacting what we'd just seen. Yeah, it was really a good time.
The only reason why I play cowboys and Indians now is that my little brother can't play anything else, the only thing he knows of, and he keeps nagging me, so I have to play with him. And it's quite fun all the same. I don't want to be cowboys, I like the Indians. On my birthday, nobody came as Indians, so it had to be cowboys and cowboys.
Come on, we'll rush.
Hold it, Rod. Seems Tano has a better idea.
We make bow from greasewood branch, make arrow from arrowweed. Dip arrow in oil we bring for lamp.
Hey, Whitaker, fire arrows!
That did it. Keep at it, Tano.
All right, out the back way.
There is no back way.
Then we stand and fight.
You know, I'll never forget the look on Notch's face when he recognized Tonto and the Lone Ranger.